Welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. How is the caramel kid?
What is the white devil saying?
He's doing good. We're recording this on Monday morning. It's going to go out on Monday, so we're recording today. So if you hear this on Monday, it's almost live, but not quite. But anyway,
fresh out the kitchen now.
Fresh out the kitchen. Yeah. I'm sitting in my spare bedroom. The sun is shining, which is nice. I'm about to go for a buggy run. I've been doing loads of buggy runs with my little baby Greta.
But I like you say that buggy. Is that the new trend now?
It's the new trend. I'm loving it. It's funny though, because I'm almost doing one every day now, like a little half an hour, 40 minutes. She's all right with it. She sings to me on the way back. Well, not sings, she gurgles and makes some funny noises, but I think she's enjoying it. And I've noticed, you know, I've always had a dodgy left shoulder, right? My shoulder does something weird, my left shoulder. But I've noticed I can't run with my, because I run one-handed right on the buggy, push sideways one-handed, and the other hand swings. I can't run pushing it with my left hand. My right arm just feels all real awkward. So I look really stupid trying to make my right arm do some work on the way around. So if anyone sees me through the parks of Amsterdam, I look like a right tit running around trying to work out how to use my right over shoulder. But hey, it's been good. I'm enjoying it.
Like, one of my pet hates is when I see a parent get on with their child.
Yeah.
And the child's like, nye, 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 and they want to buzz the oyster on the bus.
Oh, yeah.
So the parent gives them the oyster card and they can't reach it. Yeah. So they're scrambling around and then they buzz in and they've just wasted like 30 seconds of my life. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they look at me smiling like, oh, how cute. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I see this every day. Get on with
it. Don't do that, Sean. Don't be one of these people. But my story. So if anyone was in Waterloo at the weekend, they might have seen this.
Yeah.
So I'm driving along and homeless people. There's a few homeless people that hang outside Waterloo.
Yeah.
There was one of them passed out, like asleep, right almost outside the entrance of Sainsbury's.
Yeah, okay.
And he's one of his mates had obviously put, you know, those A-shaped signs that go outside shops.
Yeah.
They've stuck it over his head. So when he wakes up, he's going to bang his head. Yeah. So obviously I looked at it and I was thinking, oh, that's weird. And as I'm driving past him, obviously I can see the rest of his body. And he's in a bent position, but laid down. Yeah. They've been pulled his pants down. So he's just got his ass out to the whole of Waterloo. Yeah. I was like, what? And I burst out laughing. And then the woman next to, obviously, the driver, she was like looking at me. And I looked over there and then she started laughing. She's like, crazy. I was like, that's just stupid.
Yeah. What are they getting up to on the streets these days? Putting each other's pants down.
Yeah. I don't know, but I was like, man, that's bad. That is bad. Yeah. Imagine he wakes up, he's going to bang his head and he's going to have, his arse is going to be frozen.
Yeah. He's already got a hangover. Well, potentially. Yeah. I also had, speaking of the bus stories, this isn't quite a bus story, it's a train story, but Minky Wilmer, our friend Minky Wilmer, Amanda, she tagged me in a Twitter thing this week. Did you see it? Like, there's a video of a train driver, basically in a London train, an overground train, and he'd forgot to turn the tannoy off, and he was sitting on his front seat watching pornography, and it was like, oh yeah, it was really funny. Yeah,
so I said, that's so bad.
Yeah, he said, Amanda said, this shouldn't happen on buses. Yeah, make sure Jermaine doesn't see this; he'll get the wrong idea. Yeah.
But why would you want to be aroused when you're at work?
I've got because no you can't do that. Idea. Yeah. Unless being aroused is your work, do you know what I mean? You might be someone that needs to be aroused at work, but if you don't,
well, it's your motivation to keep, you know, like, grind out the day.
To keep those trains moving. Yeah. I reckon that guy's probably had himself sacked. But anyway, yeah.
Oh boy,
nice story. But you probably haven't seen this, Jermaine, because your mind's off running at the moment. You're not thinking about getting out and running. But there was
I was into the football because obviously big weekend of football.
Oh, Liverpool. A big week.
Liverpool missed out. Yeah, because obviously Man City won the league. Liverpool just missed out.
Yeah. But who's in the Champions League final? That was bad. Because obviously being here in Amsterdam, I had to support Ajax. And that was, that was a tough day. I was watching it with some mates in the building of mine. And that was a bitter pill to swallow. Tottenham didn't deserve it. If you're not English, Tottenham did not deserve that.
Who was you cheering?
Ajax.
Locals.
Ajax, yeah.
You know what? You should stay there. Don't come back to when you're in your band.
But I think someone said to me, like, are you going to make your daughter support? I support Middlesbrough, right? And I thought, and are you going to support Middlesbrough? And I said, why would I want to inflict that pain upon my daughter? She was born in Amsterdam. She's got to support Ajax. If she likes football, you're not going to force her into it. It's not a slavery. But hey, yeah.
Well, you never know. She could be a women's football's getting big at the moment. They're putting it on TV more. They're pushing it. Yeah. So you never know. She could be a footballer.
She could be a football star. Yeah, little Greta. She's already, well, she's not standing up and running about. Well, sort of running about. I have to hold her. But so, yeah, you never know. Strong legs already. Let's see.
So tell me about the running stuff. What's going on in the running?
Well, there's not much going on in the world of running. And apart from in the UK, we had a cracking 5K race. It was called the Ipswich Twilight 5K road race, and I think it's part of the British Championship. It might be in the English or British Championship 5K, and it was amazing. I think there was two standout performances. That was Laura Whiteman ran the fourth fastest road 5K time of all time, a British time, obviously, 15:22. So she smashed it. She won by almost 27 seconds, I think. So the nearest finisher was Claire Duck, who finished.
Was
in 15,
that a separate
15,
race, or was
no,
it
they're
mixed
all in
race?
All in together? So it's okay, a mixed race. But a cracking time from her. And in the men's race, the seventh fastest of all time, UK time, was run by Nick Gulab. Apparently, the only person that's gone faster in the last two decades was Mo Farah. So, amazing time from Nick Gulab. He ran 13:34, which is great. Exciting times for Britain. We're getting some good racing going together. People are like committing to going down to these events and getting racing together, which we were great at in the 80s. Just, you know, every weekend getting and racing. I think it's happening a bit more now. People are getting in good races, and there's good races going on which offer good competition.
But
and
maybe
it's really showing.
It weren't nothing to do with the GPS. Maybe the short was a little caught. course was a little short.
Yeah, definitely looks like it. Yeah, there were so many guys going under 14 minutes. Surely it was short. Yeah.
I've done a short 10K.
Yeah.
The Manchester 10K.
Yeah.
And I think the top 30 people all ran sub 30.
Really? Well, that's got to be short.
But it was only 100 metres short. Yeah. So everyone was running fast anyway. But because it was short, everyone said, oh, yeah, it was, you know, like 1K short. I was like, it was 100 metres short.
Yeah. But these guys at Ipswich, I'm sure they're doing it right. I'm sure there's no danger of it being short. But, yeah, good performances there. Nice one. We've got an interesting interview today. But it's about, we mentioned it last week on the show, and it's with a couple of guys. Firstly, we're going to interview Andrew Steele. So Andrew Steele is a bronze medalist at the Beijing Olympics in the 4x400 meter hurdles. 4x400 meter relay. So we're going to talk
he's
to him
about... He's too small to hurdle.
Yeah, he's too small to... So he's going to talk to us about his career, but also he works for a company called DNA Fit. So DNA Fit basically, well, we're going to talk a lot about it in a minute, but they look at athletes and the general population's DNA and attempted to provide advice on the types of trainings that might work for you based upon your genetic makeup. So we'll go into more detail about it a bit later. But Andrew works for them. He is a good example of someone who should have spent more time focusing on or should have had, if he'd had this kind of information to him when he was an athlete, might have helped him train better and might have helped him qualify for London 2012. So we'll talk to him about that. And we're also
what did
gonna,
he need?
Well, we'll leave that. He's going to explain it all in a minute. But
okay.
We're also going to have my own DNA test. So I did the test to see what it meant for me. So after that, Tom Lancashire, another Olympian, he ran the 2008 Olympics as well in Beijing. He takes me through my results and talks about two things. I've got two reports. One was which is looking at your sort of it's called the fitness test. So it looks at what kind of what your genes are receptive to in terms of training type. But also, we do a diet test as well. So it looks at what kind of foods my genes, again, are receptive to, what kind of diet would work best for me based on my genetic makeup. So that's going to come second. We do two reports there.
That sounds good stuff. That sounds like good stuff.
Yeah, I was really shocked by some of the stuff that came out. So it's an abridged version. Tom spent an hour with me on the phone. So a really great service from him talking me through all the stuff. And I've had to cut that down for you guys, for your listening pleasure. You don't need to know everything about my genes. Hell no. Some stuff's got to remain private. But yeah, he'll talk about that and he'll go this route. But you had a genetic test as well. It was a slightly different, right? Let's talk about that.
I had a normal DNA test to see my heritage.
Yeah.
And the results, I got them in front of me, 34% England, Welsh and European.
Oh, yeah.
Then 28%, 28% Tongo.
Tongo? You should be playing rugby. The Tongan boys are massive. What happened to your frame?
And then, what are you talking about? I said, "Hey, I should have been a shot putter. Should have been a shot putter. Hey, I'm the runt of the litter. What can I say?" And then 13% Cameroon.
Cameroon. Who'd have believed it? Roger Miller over there.
Yeah. 9% Irish and Scottish. Yeah. And this was the funny one. 6% Norwegian.
You wear gloves too much to be Norwegian, surely.
And then obviously it goes down. It goes 4% Mali, 3% Ivory Coast, and then 1% French, 1% Senegal, 1% North African. It's crazy.
Yeah,
so,
wow.
That's a crazy big mix.
Yeah, wow. That's interesting, though. So you got more in common with Emmanuel Adebayor than you knew.
All I know, it's not obviously not Jamaican, because obviously all Jamaicans originally were stolen from Africa.
Yeah.
A bit of Bob Marley.
Yeah.
But yeah, so obviously that's... That's the mix. Crazy, huh?
Wow. Jeez, Norwegian Togan. That's what we're going to call you now. There's no longer the Caramel Kid. The 6% Norwegian.
I'm a bit Viking.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I don't know where I'm from. It doesn't give me that information. But we should go ahead and listen to these
You should interviews. Do one.
I should do one. I'll be up for it. I'd struggle to guess where I'm from. Probably just Ireland and England, me.
But also, they give you, obviously, you can... Put your DNA, and then if you've got relatives, like genetic relatives, you can contact them.
Ah, right. So you haven't got you're not related to any famous.
Well, I turned mine off because I don't want to be people contacting me, so I just turned that off.
Nice. Well, let's listen along to Andrew Steele. He's going to chat to us about his heritage, but his running career and his how DNA Fit works and how he's come to work with them. So here we go. And then after that, you get my report. Nice. So we're here in a small cubby hole in King's Cross, chatting to Andrew Steele, bronze medalist from the 2008 rather, Beijing Olympics in the 4x400 meter relay. How you doing, Andrew?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, very good. I'm glad to be so cozy with you in this cubby hole is a generous way of describing it. It was officially a wardrobe until we turned it into a meeting room. So.
It works.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. It's good. Yeah,
So I want to start by looking at your running career and looking about. Well, we'll start basically at the very beginning and how you got involved with the sport. What was the spark that got you interested in athletics as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, without wishing to bore people with, like, you know, monotonous sort of this happened and that happened. And I guess, like, I was quite tall for my age when I was young, very young, you know, and so I used to just run, like, a lot, because I think when you're a kid, like, if you're good at something, you tend to do more of it, right? And so I think I found, like, playing football or just running with my mates, I was a bit faster than them. Yeah. And so I was like, to myself, my identifier was like, oh yeah, I'm a fast runner. And then I had that sort of got recognised in my primary school a little bit. And I had a really amazing teacher, a guy called Mr. Felstead, who used to take us for extra like training for cross country. And he also, you know, so pushed me to join an athletics club. And actually really, really early on, I joined Trafford Athletics Club. And when I was 8 years old, I joined my coach, Steve Ball, who went on to be my coach for my entire career. So from 8 years old, I was actually with the same coach. Wow. And he coached me through till I was 28. So past the Beijing Olympic Games, past London 2012 and not making it there until the last few years of my career, I moved to London. But yes, I had so very early on, I joined this athletics club and I just was, you know, I was an okay runner. I was never like the greatest, but that was just a passion, I guess, in terms of I could win some stuff and I could show off about it, you know.
Yeah. And what events were you interested in specifically when you started out?
It's mostly cross country, really. Yeah, I did like I used to run a lot of, you know, as everyone probably listening to this did, if they, you know, took running seriously when at school, and a lot of grim, muddy cross countries. Obviously from Manchester, so they're even grimmer up north. And, some terrible weekends spent running through mud and snow at places like, I think it was Clayton Vale, used to run the Greater Manchester Cross Country Championships, that had this horrendous hill in and stuff. I did all that more or less until I was about 14, where I started to sort of, you know, run sort of on the track a little bit more and sort of started to thrive a bit more there, you know. But I can actually remember the first 400-metre race I ever ran. Yeah. I ran it in 72 seconds. Wow. And it was actually at Trafford Athletics Club at Longford Stadium. And I remember doing that specifically. You used to break at that age. You'd break after 100 metres and sort of come into lane one, even on a 400. So, yeah.
But then what then made you go for that shorter distance? Was that your area of strength, did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think mostly when you're young, like, you end up doing the thing which you're best at, you know, just because, you know, not because really of any preference. I think I probably found sprinting, you know, a bit more exciting than the distance running at the time.
Yeah.
And actually, I was okay at it, you know. So I wasn't good enough. I certainly wasn't good enough to be a short sprinter. You know, there was no two ways about it. I couldn't start to save my life, and that really went my whole career. I couldn't start, and I never could, and I still can't to this day. But the 400 meters seemed to be the one that I did best at. I think because, and when I look back on it now, I think I've no natural talent at all, apart from the ability to withstand discomfort more than others.
Right.
And I think that was what led me to the 400 metres, is the one that if you could just put up with really unpleasant feeling for a certain amount of time, you could thrive at it. So that's been the one I got to probably by about, 13 or 14 years old, I was sort of running 400s and doing okay at them, you know.
Yeah. So. And when did you think, actually, I can take this seriously, I'm nationally good at this, or I've got potential to be nationally good?
So I think, well, I went to the English schools when I was 14 years old, and I won the bronze medal there in the 400. So by that point, I hadn't really, you know, focused exactly on it then, if I remember correctly, a little while ago now. But I think from that point, I was like, oh, I'm sort of a 400 metre runner, that's kind of what I am. And then when I was 16, I won the English school, so that was quite, you know, sort of, you know, and I don't know how I sort of came to actually be that good, but I guess at that point I was like, oh, right, I'm actually the best in the country at this.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But I still never expected it to be a job. I never expected to do it professionally. People used to ask me that, and they'd say, no, it's too hard, you have to train all this time, and, you know, no, I'm not interested in that. But, you know, before long, when I was 18 and I had the choice of going to university or taking a gap year, I think I got onto the funding program, and someone gave me a few grand, and I got to do a race in Italy, and I won some money when I won that race. I was like, oh, right, okay, that's that decision made then. And actually, my biggest regret looking back is that I still didn't go to university, actually, because of running, because I just sort of got into the habit of doing it, and I never went. But actually, I could have done both, actually, you know, realistically. So sort of by the time I was about 17, 18, somebody gave me like 200 euros for winning this race, and I was able to show off that, hey, I'm going to Italy for a race. Yeah. And before I knew it, I was sort of 12 years down the line, and I'd never been to university in the end. So just sort of kind of fell into the professional side of it, if you will. And what
was your training like then? So training for that event, what did your sort of training look like with, was it Steve?
Yeah, Steve Ball is called. So, the way I describe it is sort of like classic sort of old school 400 meter training that we used to do. So if anyone, you know, listening has been had the misfortune of running a 400 meters properly, you'll know it's kind of like a really long, uncomfortable sprint. So it's a really long, unpleasant sprint. You have to be quite good at elite in sort of the power side of that equation, and also have a pretty decent, like, elite level status in the sort of endurance end of the equation. So it uses every energy system there is, from your very short, fast energy sources like ATP through to, you know, your aerobic system. So it uses every fuel source. So you kind of need to be able to cover the ground that way. We used to train, I guess, being from Manchester and, you know, sort of having a sort of northern salt of the earth type cliche in us, we used to train just lots and lots of graft mileage, if you will. So generally speaking, at the top level, 400 meter runners train like 200 meter runners who do some endurance training. So, you know, the higher up the ladder you go, the more prevalence of the sprint based 400 meter training protocol. So there, because most of the race is still using the sprint energy systems right up until sort of the last 100 so meters, you're kind of using these sprinters energy systems, so it makes sense, and that's very effective for some people. But at that time in my career, also 18 through to sort of 23, 24 years old, we used to train more like middle distance athletes. So, you know, we'd do things like 20 times 200. We'd do a lot of sort of cross country type mileage and fartleks, etc., and, you know, interval stuff. And and we weren't really known for doing any short stuff at all. You know, I was terrible at the blocks. I always was. I always will be. And, you know, we when the weather got nice, which was rare, we'd do a bit of short stuff. But we really weren't. We were very much the speed endurance to endurance end of that spectrum, as opposed to the really short stuff. And that was quite effective for me. I, you know, made the Beijing Olympic Games, ran under 45 seconds, which was an important benchmark, won national champs in 2007. And then, of course, it indirectly won this Olympic medal in the 4x400 meter relay in Beijing. So,
well, let's talk about that, that day. Like, what was it like as a young man qualifying for the Olympics and going there to Beijing?
I think the more I look back on it, the more amazing it was. I think, you know, stupidly at the time when you're an athlete, you don't win stuff by being overawed by how well you're doing, right? You win stuff by being considering that, absolutely, I need to be at the very default, I need to be at least in the Olympic Games. Like, that's the reason I was there, right? And you have this kind of ruthless streak to you, which you should. But it's funny because then it means later on, it's only later on in life that you appreciate how good an opportunity or experience it was to have competed at an Olympic Games, or if you subsequently miss out, which I did. So, I mean, I was sort of lucky enough to win the national champs in 2007. I did quite well. And suddenly that put me into this picture where I was like, hey, I could actually go to the Olympics. And in my mind, I was like, yeah, of course I will, because I'm a runner. And, you know, sort of I expected a lot of myself. Yeah. But I ran fast enough in 2007 to qualify me for the Olympic Games. It didn't mean I was going to get the place, but I had sort of the first box ticked. And then in 2008, it was all going fine. And the Olympic trials in Birmingham, I ran really well in the heat in the semi, and then in warm up for the final, I pulled my hamstring. I couldn't compete in the final of the Olympic trials, and so it was completely out of my hands whether I actually went to the Olympic Games or not. And it was really quite traumatic. That was really, really traumatic. Yeah. Let alone even if they did select me, I'd still only have 3 or 4 weeks to be in shape again for the Olympics. So, a little bit more than that, but, you know, had a short window. Thankfully, and you know, really thankful to this day, the selectors actually gave me that chance, right? And they put me in the team, even though I didn't run in the final of the Olympic trials, which I don't think would happen nowadays. So I was really lucky. And a good thing of my philosophy in athletics is that you should give as many people the chance to compete in as senior a competition as they possibly can. Right, it's bigger competition, which sounds sensible, but often the way selectors do it is they actually make it really hard to make the team.
Yeah.
And I know from my experience is sometimes you can step up when you reach a championship. Some people do things which you never expected them to do. Yeah. And I was one of those. So I went there with a personal best of 45.3, but generally running sort of 45.5 or high 45s. And in the Olympics, I ran 44.9 in my heat. So I dropped like this huge, huge gulf from our times just in that sort of month or so in between that Olympic trials final and the Olympic championship. So it was sort of like, you know, I really do think that, you know, it's a shame when we're sort of too elitist in our selection criteria, because I think people do step up and will step up if you're given the chance.
So
it was a great experience. And quite unlike anything else, you know. It really is.
I mean, I've never been to China, so like, I don't know what it's like there, but what was the atmosphere like in the stadium for that?
Well, so, I mean, we talk a bit about the process you go to Olympics, right? So you sort of, you know, you get to this without a holding camp. We were in Macau in this sort of luxury hotel complex, and you're not really exposed to the outside world. And then you fly in, and people think you're going to be there for ages at the games. But actually, the athletics isn't until the second week of the games, right? So we were still in this holding camp watching the Olympics on TV. And then we flew in about, I think about 3 days before my event. And then you arrive in the village and it's this astonishing sort of world of, you know, however many, I don't know if there's like 70,000 athletes or something stupid there. And it's like, it's like some sort of utopia, because everybody, no matter what income or demographic they are, all lives in these same type of apartments. You know, there's multimillionaires queuing up for their cornflakes behind people that live on the poverty line, you know, and they all have the same standing. And there's all kinds of people. There's like the smallest, there's the tallest, there's the fattest, there's the thinnest, you know, there's all, everyone's a superlative of what they are, right? And so it's a really interesting place. And you've got this 24-hour dining hall there, 24-hour free McDonald's, which is why things can go very wrong if you don't have the discipline when you're there. But it was quite an amazing thing. And then in the stadium, the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing is, you know, quite an astonishing piece of architecture. And the first time you go in there, it's quite intimidating, because I think, generally speaking, you go to a championship, and the heat and the qualification rounds are in the mornings, so it's not always that many people there. It's not always that full. Yeah. But in the Olympic Games, the difference is you turn up at 9 a.m. and there's 80,000 people there, and it's like there's no hiding place. It's just a big, big deal.
Yeah.
So you really have to. There's nothing that can quite prepare you for that. Yeah. And I think that's why some people thrive and some people don't. You know, it's a really difficult situation to plan for.
Yeah.
And I've seen some athletes that really crumbled under that difference, and as you see some athletes thrive, you know. So I'm not quite sure how you can prepare for it other than having had the best opportunities to compete at big championships as much as possible, right?
Yeah,
you know? But it was really good, and thankfully, you know, I remember the standing on the line before my sort of heat set off, my first race there in the Olympics, and the whole stadium goes absolutely silent. And they play this really intimidating foghorn for some reason. I don't know why, just to make you even more scared. And as soon as the gun went, I reacted quite well to that environment, thankfully. And ran much faster than even I probably thought I could have run. You know?
Yeah.
So that was a good turn of events, yeah.
What do you think that is? Why do you think your character means that you can step up with these big competitions? Because I've just run the London Marathon a couple of days ago, and I had stomach problems, which I'd probably put down to nerves.
Really? Yeah.
Are you able to kind of keep things really simple in your mind? What do you think? How are you able to just focus on what you're doing? Do you have a skill for that?
Well, firstly, managing the amount of variables in a sprint race is very easy, much easier than managing the amount of variables in a marathon, right? So you've got a lot longer time to manage a lot of potentially, you know, hazardous like items or issues that might come up, right?
Yeah.
In a sprint event, it's much more controllable, so I can plan a lot more for that. You know? And so that's the first thing. Like, and also, I could have got stomach issues, and just lucky I didn't, right? You know, so there's a lot of that. But you know, I do believe there's something in people's personality around whether they can perform better under pressure. I actually know from the work we've been doing in recent years, there's genetic factors that predispose you to being better placed for that, but they're all trainable still. So even if you're not born with certain genetic predispositions to be as a default well placed to perform under pressure, there are there's a training environment which you can create, which can help like train that ability to deal with the permanence of pressure. And I just think the best example you can give is there's the two sort of biggest names in Jamaican sprinting over history are Usain Bolt and Asafa Powell, right? In the 100 meters. Before Usain Bolt really came through, there was Asafa Powell, world record holder, fastest 100 meter runner ever, and really the sort of the king of the scene, right? Yeah. But he never quite did it on the big occasion, Olympic final, world championship final. Whereas Usain Bolt always did it on the big event, more or less, right? And in Jamaica, they have a thing called champs. And if everyone's never seen this, I suggest they YouTube this. It's their high school championships. It's the biggest event on the Jamaican sporting calendar. Obviously, sprinting's ingrained in Jamaican culture. You know, people quit becoming soccer players to become sprinters in Jamaica. That's how big a deal it is, right? But I'd have to fact check this, but I heard that basically Asafa Powell's school never competed in champs, the high school championships, because for some reason it wasn't big enough or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, Usain's school very much did. And almost like, so being exposed to that high pressure environment where it's make or break early on in sport, in a sporting context at least, appears to, you know, be one of those factors which you can prepare for, you know. Yeah. And so I think, you know, to any runners that are worried about how will they perform on the big occasion, is try and put yourself in as big an occasion as possible, yeah, as much as you can, right? Yeah. And so that might be just treating one of your runs a week like it's a serious thing, right? Like, I said, like, I'm emotionally invested in the quality of this, and I'm, yeah, going to make sure that I try my best. Because I used to do that. We had a big session on Sundays, and during the winter when we weren't competing, I used to treat Sunday like a race day. So Saturday I'd prepare in the same way I was going to prepare for a race. I'd wake up a bit nervous about how I was going to, you know, perform in this session. I would put it out there that I expected this certain time from myself in this rep, or, right, you know, verbally to the rest of the squad. So if I didn't, it was almost like a public disappointment that I didn't, yeah, you know. And so, and I do believe that's a really a trainable thing.
And so the individual event, you did you get through to the...
I made the semi-final in the individual event. Yeah. Didn't make it through to the final. Mm. Ran okay in the semi-final, not as well as I did in the heat. But I think I was just... I was just a bit knackered, to be honest. Like, yeah, I ran really fast in the heat, and it was quite difficult. I remember my heat was at 9:30 a.m. or something stupidly early, so I had to get up at like 4 a.m. Mm. And I'd been training my body to wake up naturally at that time in the run-up to the games, right? So 10 days before, I'd been getting up earlier and earlier, so it felt natural for me. So I was awake by the time 9:30 a.m. came around.
Yeah.
But then the semi-final, which I wasn't sure if I was going to make, was at 10 p.m. the next day. So I was like, I was ready for sleep, mate, when the semi-final started. So you know, that's a good lesson. Is you can plan everything for the first round, but if you make it through, then what are you going to do there? So, or it might just have been that I just didn't have enough in the tank to run fast twice, yeah, in a row. You know,
okay.
That way. Yeah. But so I made the semi, and then we had a few days off, and then we had the heat of the relay and the final of the relay. Yeah.
So what leg were you on the relay?
First leg. Yeah. Okay. I always run first leg.
Okay.
Probably because, you know, I don't know, just I'm not very agile. Like, I'm not very nimble. I needed my lane with no one in it. And,
okay,
you know, no complexities, no variables.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I was good at that, and I enjoyed doing the first leg. Yeah.
What was the emotion? Because were you almost neck and neck with the Russians coming down the final straight? Not you personally, but
So we, I think it was the guy who ran the fourth leg for Russia didn't run the individual event, and I think he ran like the fastest or the second fastest leg of the games. Like, he was like astonishing, and he absolutely just, like, you know, just absolutely smashed it on this last leg. I think he was on the last leg anyway. One of the runners didn't run the individual event, which is quite unusual,
yeah,
and he was absolutely their fastest.
Right.
And we left, you know, we finished the race like a little bit shocked, because we'd done all our maths and our sort of performance planning beforehand, and we said, if we can run 2:58,
yeah,
we'll definitely win a medal. No one's ever not won a medal with 2:58, and that was true.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we ran 2:58 and we didn't win a medal.
Yeah.
And we were like, where did Russia come from? We didn't factor them into our, like, planning at all as threats,
yeah,
based on the performance of their individual runners.
Yeah.
But this extra runner really changed everything there. And so we did leave that. And it's a funny, you know, it's so high emotion when you're in there, right? Because I run and you're nervous, and you run, you hand over the baton, and you're somewhat relieved you've done your job okay.
Yeah.
But then you're watching this thing and unfold, and you're up by the, you're on the track sides, you can't really see what's happening on the back straight, and just the noise and the lights and the whole feeling was just so intense, man. Like, so intense. Yeah. But and then we ran so well and so fast, faster than we thought we would at all, right? And we crossed the line, and it was like, and you don't really get anything for it. You sort of leave, and it was a really odd dynamic. And then we're flying home the next day, so you don't really have any time to even, like, comprehend what has happened, you know.
Yeah.
The 4x4 is always the last event.
Okay.
So you don't even get a chance to take advantage of the free McDonald's. It's closing down by the time you finish.
They got a couple of chicken nuggets.
And so it was just a very, it's just an extreme experience in every way, you know. But, and then, you know, so obviously we used to, you'd have the sort of like gossip around, like, yeah, well, they're always cheating, or, you know, like,
from the finish.
Okay. For sure. Like, you know, we definitely felt hard done by, but generally being sensible, most of the time in sport, like, you just have to win anyway, whether you think someone's
a
bit dodgy or not.
Yeah.
You have to just just because you have to beat them.
Yeah.
And we still didn't beat them. Yeah. Right? You know, they still run faster than us no matter what. And I'm sure I've beaten people who had been cheating in the past, and I'm sure I've been beaten by people who weren't cheating. You know, so it's like it's an absolutely a broad range of possibilities. We started to suspect that, and then, you know, years later, and I'm talking years later, so, you know, 2013, 14, there was rumours that, hey, you know, the statute of limitations not that far away for retesting these samples, and they might retest them. And there'd been some other retests that had, you know, fallen foul of new technologies lately. And we had this glimmer of hope that maybe there was something there in that.
Yeah.
And thankfully, it came to fruition in 2017. So, yeah. Wow. So, thank God, you know. So,
yeah.
So that was good. And now I have the best of both worlds. I got the Olympic medal. I actually got given it in the London Olympic Stadium.
Ah.
So I got it on a home in front of a home crowd during the London Anniversary Games. They played the anthem, which you wouldn't have got for third place normally.
Yeah.
And also I sort of get a better anecdote about how I got my Olympic medal. And I appreciate it more now, I think, than I would have done at the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Do you feel...
Yeah, I do. I think having subsequently then tried to make another Olympic Games, not made it, and understood, oh my God, how lucky I was to have got to Olympic Games at all.
Yeah,
I think I'm more appreciative of that medal now than I would have been, because back then I would have said, yeah, of course I won an Olympic medal. I'm an Olympic athlete. I should be winning medals, and sort of the high bar you set for yourself.
Yeah,
and I probably would have been disappointed it was third as opposed to gold, right?
Yeah,
and so. So now I'm really very glad to have got it this way, to be honest. And interesting, there's a separate conversation around sort of, you know, what my career would have been and how successful could I have been. Would that have stopped me from exploring other options, having had an Olympic medal in my pocket at the time and stuff? And I'm actually thankful. I'm glad I didn't win it at the time. It's quite a bold thing to say, but I think if I'd won that Olympic medal at the time, I would have been too blinkered and trapped in the fact that I can be an Olympic medalist. Yeah. And it wouldn't have led me to have such an open mind about other opportunities in life.
Okay.
And I perhaps wouldn't be in as good a position I am now in my career as a human being, not just as an athlete, had I been sort of that tiny bit more successful. My athletics career, if that makes sense.
So following that, as you, obviously London was 4 years after.
Mm.
How did that period go? What immediately after Beijing?
So running out of Beijing, like I said, I was doing this sort of endurance based protocol for 400 meters, which is quite an old fashioned way of training at 400. I think it was mostly sort of pioneered by the Eastern Europeans and doing really hard training. So there was like a Polish coach who used to, that coach had this textbook of this Polish coach who'd do ridiculous rep numbers and all this stuff. And we were quite influenced by it.
Yeah.
And then as we went to 2012, of course, we had 4 years to go from running about 44.9 to ideally running about 44.4. So about half a second quicker. And I always put that in perspective, is that it's literally the amount of time it takes me to click my fingers. It's that much time. That's all it is. I only had to get that much quicker over 4 years.
Wow.
Right?
That's
ridiculous, isn't it? But that's hard. You know, I can't believe now that's hard to do something that much quicker. It's like ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
In a sprint event. It turned out to be an insurmountable challenge. I couldn't do it. But anyway, what happened was you have this kind of annual performance review with, you know, people that pay your bills. Mm-hmm. At the time it was, Charles Van Comenay, who was our performance director and a great performance director. Mm-hmm. And quite rightly, it was said, well, look, you're pretty bad at the start of your race, right? And you're pretty slow at 200 meters compared to other athletes of your standard at 400, right? So other athletes who could run 44 seconds in 400 were much quicker than me at 200 meters, often like a second quicker than me. They were a lot quicker.
Yeah.
And so the logic went, well, look, most people at the top level do a sprint-based training program. You're weak on the sprint bits. If you do this sprint-based training program, you will probably get half a second off your time like that, for free, right? You know, it's almost like it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's the considered correct advice. It's the more well-used protocol.
Yeah.
And you're weak at the bits which that protocol addresses. So it was a very sensible piece of advice. And so what we set out on a path to over the next 4 years was to, you know, go closer to that method, that sprint training method. And look, I think that sometimes you look back and you think, well, if you were doing well, You know, why did you change? But the point is, you always think you can get better, right?
Yeah,
no matter what.
Absolutely.
And you know, so you just don't know. And and this seemed like an exciting thing to do. And so we did that. And crucially, over those 4 years, like, it was a torrid 4 years. I got glandular fever for a bit. That didn't help. I had a constant sort of Achilles troubles. I had a lot of problems over those 4 years. But ultimately, I lost my individual calling card, which was my very good last 100 metres. Okay. So I used to be able to hold my top pace for a bit longer than most other 400 metre runners, I think. Mm. And I didn't really have that. And crucially, I didn't really get that much better at the short stuff either. Like, I was better technically out of the blocks, but still terrible compared to everyone else. At my 200 meter speed, didn't get any quicker. I probably ran technically a little bit better, but I just didn't have that strength. I didn't double down on my strengths, basically. And that really meant that actually, instead of going forward, instead of getting a half second quicker, on average, I got about a second slower. So when it came to 2012, the last race before selection, I ran 45.94 seconds, if I'm correct. And that was exactly 1 second slower than I ran 4 years prior at the Beijing Olympic Games, 44.94 seconds. And I actually missed out on making the team for London. So
yeah.
I didn't even make the final of the trials. And I finished ranked seventh, I think, that year, and they take the top six. So I actually missed out on making the team, let alone winning an individual medal like we'd been planning for. That change in protocol was a major contributing factor, I believe, to actually me not actually making the team at all. And that was quite a difficult thing to go through. Like,
yeah.
Because I don't know, anyone you'll ever speak to who competed in London will know that sort of from 2005 when we awarded the Games, it pervaded every single breath of your life, because everyone you ever met and you told them you were an athlete or a sports person of any kind, like, oh, you're going to be in London. And it just became like the average, you know, you'd wake up and like, oh, London 2012, London. It was literally every waking moment was defined by whether you were going to be at London 2012 or not.
Yeah.
And so to have made the previous Games, 2008, and then not make it to London was really hard. And as you know, it was kind of like the biggest cultural event that's ever happened here in the UK, right? It changed everyone's lives almost from here. And so that was very difficult to miss out on that. It got made better by, you know, one of my best friends, Greg Rutherford, actually winning gold in the long jump. And that was an amazing sort of, you know, positive thing that came out of it. But I didn't make the team. And that was grim to deal with from a personal level.
Yeah. And so post that and dealing with that disappointment, did you continue to compete then? What did you do after that?
Yeah, so I was still very much competing. So I got to a certain point where I'd had some time off. I dealt with the mourning of the loss of like not making it to 2012.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I remember looking at my options and I was like, well, I could just go and get a job, but I've got no CV. I've never been to university. I've got no education.
Yeah.
I've got quite a lot of financial debt that I've racked up in pursuing this London 2012 dream. And I was in a bad place, mate, as a sort of, you know, human being, right? And so I was like, well, I have to press on, right? You know, what other options have I got?
I'm in this
time. Yeah, I'm in, right?
Yeah.
But I thought, what I did say to myself was, well, two things. Firstly, I've learned through trial and error what worked for me and what didn't. And if I'm going to press on, I'm going to do what my instinct says and what my experience says that works better for me. And that was the endurance-based training method, right? So I was like, I'm going to go back to the old school. I'm going to, you know, that might be the way that works for most people, but the old way, the other way that doesn't work for most, did work for me. I've had an 8-year test period for that. 4 years to one Olympics, 4 years to another.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm going to do that. That's a given. And then secondly, I thought, I'm not going to be as defined by this ability to run 400 meter running as I had before. So I'm going to have to work anyway. I'm going to have to work, but I'm also just going to, in my mind, I'm going to allow myself to be something else other than just a 400 meter runner.
But that must be hard.
It was very hard, man. Yeah, but looking back at it and having been around a lot of, you know, elite performers is maybe it's unique to the power events, to the sprint events, but the higher up you go, the more relaxed they are about life. Yeah. 100%, you know, the dedication doesn't necessarily go up with the achievement, right? Yeah. With the talent level. And I think there's something in that.
Yeah.
Is that there needs to be this balance between what you do for a living and who you are. Just as in work life, you have to have a work-life balance. I think in sport, you need a sport-life balance.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, working, training harder and being more obsessed doesn't always yield the output of being better. Probably conversely, it does the opposite,
yeah.
You know, to an extent.
Yeah.
So I made that decision and I think that was quite helpful. What also happened is I had a change in my life. I moved down to London. My wife had been working in London for a few years, so I was no longer sacrificing that part of my life for sport.
Mm.
And that made me a bit happier too. And at the same time, I got sent a swab, basically by an entrepreneur who was starting a new company looking at genetics. And he was interested in feedback from sports people. On you know how they saw the test or how they saw the products. At the time it was very basic, but it came at the same time as this sort of learning about what worked for me and what didn't, and my understanding that I was different than the average, let's say. And then the report that I got told me that I was different than the average too. So that led me to start to work with DNA Fit as really sort of, you know, one of the first few employees. And basically that was the first early days of the company DNA Fit, and that was looking at a selection of genetic variants, so how I'm made, the you know that genetic part of this sort of nature nurture equation, and actually how do they interact with training stimulus, with environment stimulus, food, etc. And one of the key things which is important here is there's a gene which is often called like the Olympic sprint gene, right? And this gene's called ACTN3. And with every gene, you can have one of three versions. They're all communicated by selections of letters, which you will have gone through when you've gone through your own reports. And in the ACTN3 gene, you can have either two copies of the C version of the gene. So your genotype would be CC. You can have two copies of the T. So you'd be TT or one of each CT. Mm. And the C version is overly represented amongst elite sprint athletes. So Olympic level sprint athletes, different estimations put the presence of the C allele, that's what that letter's called, that C variant of the gene of ACTN3, somewhere upwards of 97% of Olympic level athletes have that.
Mm.
In a lot of studies, actually 99%. So almost every Olympic sprinter ever genotyped has the C version of that gene, and I didn't have it. I'm TT. That's so rare that there's even case studies about elite power athletes who don't have the C version of the gene published in scientific literature.
Wow.
So it's a very rare occurrence to find an elite level sprinter without the C version of this gene.
Mm.
Part of the reason is the C version of that gene is very good at building fast twitch muscle fiber if you give it sprinter activity, so power activity.
Mm.
Looking back at it with sort of nice kind of probably a bit of confirmation bias about what worked for me, it didn't, but there's still an element there, I'm sure, in terms of that sprint training method meant I was probably getting less of that physiological benefit from that sprint training than the people I would train with, than other sprinters.
Yeah.
So maybe one of the reasons why that sprint protocol was less effective for me was that from a genetic level, I'm an anomaly, so therefore my training needed to be an anomaly too.
Right.
And it was just quite a powerful learning, and a few other things, particularly raised risk of a couple of injuries, a couple of them specifically around like Achilles tendinopathy risk, and I've suffered with that all my life, and recovery speed was sort of impaired with a bigger inflammatory response based on a few genes, and that fitted in quite well with how I needed to build my training program historically. And so a few of these things, I was just like, wow, okay, that kind of meets my experience.
Mm.
And I just wrote back to this guy and said, hey, you know, by the way, this is what you've told me, and this is what I found in my career. Well done. You're onto something.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, I'll get some sponsorship out of this or something. I'm an athlete, you know.
Yeah.
But and then it turned into a working relationship, which actually turned out to be very fruitful. And here we are 6 years later now, actually, and the company's got 120 odd staff in the group, and we've done really well, I guess. You know, it's grown a lot. So
yeah.
So that really happened as I was, after London, I was still competing, but we started building this company too.
Yeah.
And DNA Fit started to grow. And eventually, I did quite well in those years. I ran my second fastest, probably my second best season ever in 2014. And then age started to catch up with me a bit. And I sort of my career kind of got overtaken by, my career at DNA Fit kind of overtook the athletics a little bit in my head.
Yeah.
And we sort of moved on, you know. But so yeah, I stopped running officially in 2016, but really sort of 2015 onwards, I was really on the way out. There are two ways around it, but yeah, so it was good.
Did it make you think you wished you'd done it differently? Do you have regrets?
I wish I'd stuck to my guns more in 2008 after the Beijing Olympic Games. Knowing what I know now about how I made and also just my experience at the time, I wish I'd been a little bit more bullish to say, well, no, you know what? This is working for me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to distract from that. But it's quite hard, right? You've got people that pay your bills and the people that you consider senior and more knowledgeable than you. I was only 23 years old and you know, saying, well, okay, everyone else does this. And I'm looking at these other athletes going, well, they do that and they are a bit faster than me. So maybe I should also do that, right? And, you know, looking back with all the benefits of, you know, looking back, you could say, okay, ideally I should have just stuck to what I was doing and pressed on.
Yeah.
But I wasn't to know that at the time, you know. But that's where we come in now. Hopefully we give sort of a little bit of genetic data in there which helps inform decision-making. It shouldn't change everything at all.
Yeah.
It should be another layer which is considered in the decision-making process.
Yeah.
And if I'd had that layer, maybe that would have been an important sort of small change in direction I was taking at the time. Yeah.
It's interesting, you always hear this conversation, this statement of you're an experiment of one. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
N equals one. Yeah. So you are a sample size of one.
Yeah. But you never really do it. You never really follow it. It's difficult when you see other people training and you look at everyone's Strava and all this sort of
thing. Yeah.
But I guess this is part of this. Having your genetic test is a way to kind of to delve more deeply into that.
Yeah, or just like I said, an extra element to consider in finding that way for you, right? So the best way to put it is, you know, we tend to be overly influenced and too influenced in general by what the best person does, right? So if we said, I want to be a sprinter, what did Usain Bolt do in training?
Yeah.
Okay, well, he's famous for eating chicken nuggets before his final. Does that mean you should also eat chicken? Absolutely not, right? He's very different than you.
Yeah.
So that success paradox, I think it's called, is the concept of it, is that you shouldn't necessarily be overly influenced by the person who's absolutely the best, you know? there's ways that work for you. And I think my sort of opinion is that we all have very different routes to success, very different, even within, you know, very narrow criteria, such as 8 400 meter runners who are all Olympic finalists. The way they get to that final and the way they would train to win that final will be very different from person to person. And that's a very narrow niche, right? Yeah. So I think the point is just, you have to find what works for you.
Yeah.
And I think you have to hopefully, you know, make some of that decision, not just based on instinct, because it's very hard to believe just your instinct. It's very hard to stick to that, you know, is to get as much data as possible about yourself and use that in a sort of conservative manner to make a decision.
Yeah.
So that's where we come in, is not to change your goal. Yeah. Absolutely not. But if you want to reach a certain goal, how might knowing how you're made, as well as everything else you know, your heartbeat, your steps, your GPS, your weight, whatever metric, when we're very used to measuring these things and not taking them out of the context, but also just using them in a sensible way.
Yeah.
Right? You might go, okay, my VO2 max is not its highest, but my lactate threshold's way up. So, or I'm running much faster, so I don't mind, right? Yeah. You know, so you never take another metric out of context. And same with genetics, it should be one metric that we use.
Yeah.
And it might help you personalize or use some data to personalize that route to your goal as opposed to change the goal itself. That's like the quite important distinction I would make with genetics versus people tend to think of DNA as kind of some sort of dystopian future where, you know, or like Gattaca, everyone's with Aldous Huxley, sort of like what you can or can't be or will or won't be.
Yeah.
And the thing is, as humans, we're all made on this like interaction between how we're born, what with the sort of genetic cards we're dealt, and our environment, how we grew up, our lives, the choices we make, what we eat, where we live, the air quality, all these other factors, right?
Yeah.
And it's that interaction where it matters, not one or the other. And it's not nature or nurture, it's always both, no matter what it is. Okay. And so what we're saying is we can shine a light a bit on that genetic equation when it comes to exercise and nutrition to help you better personalize and understand controlling the other bits, the variables that you then can change in your life as well. So, so it's just sort of that interaction that matters. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully, you know, it's just you understand better how to reach your goal, which you've chosen, but not to change the goal in itself.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to be a sprinter, even if I might have not had that Olympic sprint gene, right? So if you told me at 14 you don't have it, and it'd been miscommunicated that means my chances of being an Olympic sprinter are much less, and maybe I wouldn't have tried, right? So it's very important you don't use this as a kind of predictive talent identification, because the evidence just isn't there, you know? It's actually, but what it can do is, the way I trained to be an Olympic sprinter could have been influenced a little bit by that, and you know, go one end of the spectrum versus the other.
Yeah. And then, and how, for a runner like me, obviously I've done my test and I've got a consultation coming up in the next year with Tom. How would I get involved in it? What kind of products do you offer?
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole point of what we do is that it's like, it's very low barrier to entry, if you will, right? The technology we use now, thanks to sort of reduction in cost, is completely sort of affordable. Whereas, to give you an example, the test we do today, if we'd done the same test on you maybe close to 15 to 20 years ago, it could have cost almost $1 million per person to do.
Right? Jesus.
The technology, the lab technology, has come down in cost by about 99% in the last 15 years. It's an astonishing difference. And basically, what we do is, we have a couple of products. One which just looks specifically at nutrition, the way your genetics interact with food choices. Another which looks at both fitness and nutrition. So on the exercise side, for runners, I guess that'd be the first point of contact, and then the second would be your nutrition. You'll buy a box. That box has like a little swab in it. It's like a cotton bud on the end of a stick, basically. That's all it really is. That's rubbed on the inside of the cheek, and it's sent back in the mail. And in that, we'll then analyse for selection of genetic variants, which are the most researched around the way that genetic variant responds or interacts with a certain exercise habit or a nutrition habit. So we'll look at, in exercise, we look at four factors. So one, training intensity response, selection of genes, which depending on the version you have, may place you in a sort of better responder to a different end of the intensity spectrum, so power or endurance. And we can use that in context with your goal to sort of tweak little bits of that training program to make them a little more effective. Then injury risk, recovery speed, and VO2 max trainability, so aerobic trainability.
Yeah.
And then nutrition-wise, there's a whole host of stuff around the way you respond to carbs, to fats, whether you might need more of certain nutrients and vitamins than the average guidelines, and even how you metabolize caffeine, for example, which is a very popular pre-run, pre-workout substance.
Yeah.
But if you're a fast metabolizer, you probably get a little bit more benefit from that for performance than slow metabolizers, and that's almost entirely dependent on a genetic variant that you might have.
Okay.
So quite, you know, and then you get like an online portal and a coach to sort of talk you through those results as well, with our app as well, and a few other things, a genetically guided training platform and a genetically guided meal planning platform as well. So, so it's quite cool. Yeah. But it's very simple, basically. You know, and these things are, you know, down at sort of low hundred something pounds, occasionally with sales like just under £100. So it's really not like a lot in the grand scheme of things.
No.
And considering your DNA never changes, it's actually data that you can hopefully use like for the rest of your life with that single test.
Yeah. Mm. Well, on that note, I should probably go over to the consultation with Tom.
He's waiting for it.
To see what he has to say about me.
Yeah, good. Well, you know, he's got a good background, as you know, so Olympian himself as well, so I hope he'll be well placed to put your results into context.
Fantastic.
So,
Well, thanks so much for your time.
No problem.
We'll see what Tom has to say.
Great.
You, obviously, you're a runner, so what sort of, how much running are you doing currently? Is it sort of affected by the new baby, or is it, have you managed to keep going?
It is a little bit, I'm probably running once a day now, like I was.
Okay.
So probably when I was running at my best in a couple of years ago, I was probably running, you know, around 90 miles a week, and I'd say it's down to about 70 now, and it probably maybe even less than that. But what I'm doing is I'm following, so I'm running the London Marathon next week.
Oh, right. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm doing, I did a big block to Frankfurt before the baby arrived, which was like based on sort of Canova principles. So I was doing
it wasn't actually that high mileage. I probably was only doing 75 miles a week, but I was doing two kind of quite big major sessions in the week, which would be up to 25-30k, and one up as far as 40-42k, which is sort of hard effort. So
yeah,
I'm doing that, an abridged version of that at the moment. So not as much extra running, and certainly not any of the core work or anything like that I was doing previously. But I am still doing, I'd say, at least 70 miles, I reckon.
Right. Okay. What we're looking to do is not sort of look at this and say, oh, you actually should be a sprinter, or, you know, what. Yeah. We can't look at this and say what you might be good at or not good at. It's purely about if you are training for a marathon, or if you're trying to kind of endure, this is the sort of way we should go about it to get the most from your training. And if you're trying to, you know, become Mr. Universe and build a load of the muscle, this is probably the best way to think about it, this particular way. So what you do is up to you, but how you can go about doing it and getting more from it is what we're trying to achieve with this.
Okay.
With marathon training, obviously it's more complicated than just do endurance or do some, you know, higher intensity running or whatever. There's lots of, same with my event at 1500, there's lots of different elements that come into it. But
yeah,
generally speaking, sort of guide people in the right direction about what sort of things to be focusing on and how they can get the most bang for their buck, really, from the type of training that they're doing.
Perfect.
So we look at these things called SNPs, which are single letter variations in genes that slightly alter how the gene functions. And it's totally normal. Everyone has these variants, and it's part of what makes us all different.
Yeah.
But we can look at them, look at which variants you have, and look at where we can get the biggest response. So when you're training, essentially what you're doing is stressing your body, and the goal is that your body responds to that stress, adapts, and becomes better at dealing with it next time.
Yeah.
And that's how we get fitter. So what we're looking to is maximize that response.
Yeah.
So the first thing on this report is this power and endurance profile on page 6.
Yeah.
And the first thing to remember with this is a measure of what you're good at or not good at. So obviously you can see you have a bigger power response than endurance response. As someone who's training for a marathon, obviously you're better at endurance now than you are at power.
Yeah.
So we can't really know that from genetics alone. Yeah. What this is telling us is about your response to different types of exercise stimulus. Or more specifically, are you someone who responds really well to a high intensity approach to exercise, or someone who responds much better to a lower intensity, more volume based approach? So as a simple example, for me as a middle distance runner, if my goal is to run a 4 minute mile, for example, that doesn't mean all my training is at 4 minute mile pace. You know, sometimes I'll go to the track and do 200 meter sprints, which are much faster and shorter. So a power based way of training. And sometimes I'll go and do, and you know, a 90 minute long run. Obviously, that's more of a endurance based way of training. So I do a mixture of those different approaches to reach that goal of running a 4 minute mile.
Yeah.
And the idea is that mix should reflect what we see in this profile.
Right.
As I said, obviously, you know, in my event, there's things like lactate tolerance, top end speed, speed endurance, all different things that form that training plan. But in a more simplistic way, we can look at it this way and say, is that high intensity approach something we should prioritize, or a more volume based approach?
Okay.
Or in your case, actually a bit of a mix.
Okay.
So for you, again, the exercise you're doing, whether that's running, whether it's lifting weights, that's not what we're trying to direct you on here. It's how we go about lifting weights. If you want to do weights, how we go about prioritizing your running.
Okay.
So the sort of nicest example I usually use, I know this maybe isn't necessarily super relevant to you, but if you say, came on the line and said, I'm going to the gym a lot, I want to get strong and build some muscle. In that situation, you'd be doing exercise such as lifting weights or strength exercises. Someone with a really big power response, the best way to get the biggest returns from those weights is to make them as high intensity as possible. So if you're in the gym twice a week doing squats, someone with a big power response would really be best suited to just lifting as heavy as they possibly can for a relatively small number of reps. However, if you've got a big endurance response, what that tells is you don't actually get as much from that type of stimulus. And we want to get more of the metabolic stress of really fatiguing those muscles over a longer period of time. So maybe doing sets of 15 squats where it's much, much lighter, but the end of each of those sets, you're really hitting that sort of fatigue and exhaustion. That's the stimulus that works better for endurance people. So for you as a what we call a mixed profile, what we want to ensure is that we've got elements of both in your program, where you're maybe, you know, doing things like supersets or drop sets where you're starting out very heavy and making it, you know, more endurance based as you go on, or different days with different focuses where you're,
you know, an endurance day where you're lifting much lighter, much bigger volume, followed by a power day where you, you know, just finding ways to find that mix and put your prioritizing the right areas.
Yeah. Okay. So looking at my mind's just for the benefit of the listener, like my power response is 57 and my endurance response is 43. Is that like quite typical of
actually, no. I mean, I would guess the most people tend to fall in the endurance side of things. So probably anything from 60 to 65% endurance is probably average, I would say.
Right.
It's not, again, this isn't sort of deterministic. We can't look at this and say, this is a sprinter or this is a marathon runner.
Hmm.
And I mean, a good example of that is myself and Craig Pickering, who's the head of sports science at DNA Fit. We're both Olympians. We both went to Beijing Olympics. He was in the 100 meters. I was in the 1500 meters.
Yeah.
Yet our results on this are almost freakishly similar. We're both around sort of 65% endurance to power.
Wow.
So obviously we can't look at that and say, oh, they're both middle distance runners or anything like that.
Yeah.
But what it meant was for Craig's training, especially, he found his best performances were coming from when he was actually doing what for him is sort of endurance sprint training. So rather than doing lots of really high explosive block starts, flying 30 meter sprints, you know, typical sprinter training.
Hmm.
Actually, when he was training more as a sort of 200 meter runner, doing a lot of that sort of over distance stuff for him.
Yeah.
Actually, that was when his best 100 meter performances were. So it's still sprinting and it would still be very much high intensity for me. But for him, that was a sort of more volume based way of training, which works very well for him.
Okay.
So for you, so with marathon, I always use it as a bit of a weird example, because if you're trying to run the London Marathon, there's no getting away from the fact that you have to train yourself to run 26 miles. So we can't just do nothing but sprints for you and expect you to run a good marathon. So it's what's relevant to you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're someone with a really, really big endurance response, you know, the people with 90-100% endurance responses either.
Yeah.
Almost for them, the advice is very, very mileage focused. Let's just see how much mileage we can build up, because they're so responsive to that low intensity training.
Yeah.
In terms of building new mitochondria and new blood vessels, and you know, all those adaptations happen very readily for those people.
Yeah.
For you, actually, with someone with a more significant power response, what that's telling us is actually a little bit of a quality over quantity based approach is probably going to be far more effective.
Right.
For you to get those adaptations, slightly higher intensity training is needed. Really what this is, you know, it's taking a big chunk of unknowns out of your, you know, of you. And so we can make better decisions about what sort of things are likely to work.
Yeah.
And if you said, yeah, I've changed my mind, I want to be a sprinter now, that's totally fine too. But again, we would use this information to build your training program for that.
Okay.
And then finally, injury risk. Again, there's two aspects to this. The bottom four genes are the same inflammatory genes we just looked at.
Yeah.
And that's because if you go running and you've got a swollen knee, then the range of motion is reduced. So you're more likely to just overstretch and damage something. And also when there's inflammation in a muscle, that muscle can't produce as much force. It's inhibited. So again, you're more likely to strain something, basically. Strength and conditioning as well is a big thing we can do to minimize it. So just learning to control movements around joints better.
Yeah.
You know, if you're pronating, you know, you've got a knee that drops inwards, you know, we can look at that and say, okay, potentially your glute med isn't strong enough. Let's see if we can strengthen that up and learn to control that knee movement better.
Yeah.
And again, we can just minimize risk that way.
Yeah. Okay.
But other than that, it's, as you can see, it's a low injury risk. Yeah. So very, very good thing for you. And
and that reflects reality as well. I don't pick up injuries a lot. I get niggles and things like everybody else, but I don't get injured really.
It's a largely environmentally influenced part of the test. You know, if you're a marathon runner or a rugby player, obviously you're going to get more injuries than someone who is a swimmer or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's an environmental effect. But yeah, it's nice to see there's not anything particularly screaming out here that says, yeah, we really need to wrap you in cotton wool in this sense, because it's low risk.
Yeah. Excellent.
Okay, so if you open up the diet report, the first thing we look at is on page 5, where it says optimal diet type for weight management, which for you is the low carbohydrate plan.
Okay.
There's three possible outcomes there, low carb, low fat, or Mediterranean. And the reason is, for any person, regardless of your genetics, the key thing when it comes to weight management is calorie balance. So obviously, if you're consuming more calories than you're burning, you're much more likely to put on weight. This test doesn't tell us anything about how much food you eat or how much exercise you do, so we can't really comment on your calorie balance. But what we can do is look at what sort of foods and what sort of diets can make life more difficult for you and be more unhealthy if you are trying to lose weight.
Okay.
Or maintain a particular weight.
Yeah.
So if you go forward to your carbohydrate sensitivity on page 7, you can see yours is very high, which means from a weight management perspective, essentially you're very good at processing carbs and getting calories from them. So if my sensitivity is very low and you and I eat the exact same loaf of bread, even though we both consume the same number of carbs, you would get more carbs from that bread than I do because of how efficient you are.
Right.
So it kind of sounds like a good thing for you, but if we're both on the same high carb diet, you're getting a lot more calories every day than I am, which means you have to do a lot more exercise to burn them off. So
right. Okay.
Obviously, if you're trying to lose weight, having a carb-based diet isn't really a good idea.
Yeah.
The other reason it's important, which is probably more relevant to you, I'm guessing you're exercising a lot, so weight isn't necessarily as much of an issue, but from a health perspective, when you have a high sensitivity, it means those carbs end up in your body as blood glucose much more quickly. So you get a much bigger spike, which means your body has to produce a much bigger insulin response to bring those levels back down again, which is then can be quite unhealthy if that's kind of fluctuating throughout the day.
Yeah.
So it's important for everyone to try and control blood sugar levels, but it's especially important for people to with a higher sensitivity because you're more prone to those fluctuations.
Okay.
Actually, one of the genes there, it's TCF7L2, that's an insulin sensitivity gene. And what we found with the TT version, if you're on a high carb diet, you're about 2.5 times more likely to develop type 2 diabetes than if you have the CC version.
Wow.
So it's a really strong indicator of that risk of why, you know, we should avoid being on, you know, too much carbs if you're in that group. And also then in terms of timing, you know, a lot of people get home from work, have a big bowl of pasta and then go to bed without doing any exercise.
Yeah.
That's a really bad time to have those carbs because all that glucose is just sitting in your bloodstream with nowhere to go. And that's when it ends up getting converted to body fat, messing with your insulin levels. So yeah, being smarter about it, fitting it around your exercise, choosing how and when you're going to use these calories that you're consuming.
Yeah.
Is a really good idea and just being more wary in that sense.
Yeah.
So we're not saying you need to go on, you know, cut out carbs completely.
Yeah.
But definitely being smarter with how and when you have them.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that all make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's interesting about the carbs, like because I do feel like I'm just going away on trips and stuff with other people and before races, you know, the marathon runner Robbie Simpson. And he'll eat two or three pizzas, and you think, Jesus, how the hell is he just staying the way he is, and how is he managing that? And yet, if I you know, take a few days off, I notice, I can tell the difference. Do you know what I mean? Whereas for someone like him, it's very much like he just burns it very quickly and doesn't really.
Well, I mean, the people that sort of kind of say, oh, yeah, I just have to look at a piece of bread and I put on weight, they tend to be the ones with this very high sensitivity.
Okay.
And also maybe sort of, again, more relevant for you might be thinking about timing in and around training and races as well, because what you can often find is people with higher sensitivities, they get this big sugar rush when they eat some, you know, toast with jam on or whatever it might be. But then also that kind of drops down as almost an overreaction where the blood sugar levels can drop really quickly as well after, because there's been this such a huge insulin response.
Yeah.
So you almost get, you know, if I experience the same sometimes where I sort of have something like, you know, toast with honey or whatever in the afternoon and then go for a run an hour later. I often feel really flat and lethargic and almost, you know, hypoglycemic because you've had this sort of big overreaction in terms of blood sugar levels.
Yeah.
So that's something to, you know, to be wary of in terms of your fueling for marathons and even during the marathon, you know, slower, maybe, well, during the marathon, it's probably a very different thing actually, but certainly in the hours before, avoiding anything that's going to give you this big insulin.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
What about caffeine? Do you
oh, drink shit, I drink a lot. I reckon I drink about 6 espressos a day, probably something like that, which is
okay.
Probably way too much. To be honest.
Well, so the good news is you're in the much lower risk group for caffeine.
Okay.
So if anyone was going to be drinking a lot of coffee, people like you, it's safer for. So
okay.
Caffeine's a really interesting one because it's the guidelines for caffeine, as for many things, are based on a health risk for the average person. So with caffeine, the main one is heart attack risk. Generally speaking, the more coffee you drink or the more caffeine you consume, the higher your heart attack risk.
Yeah.
And so they've decided that for most, if the average person, 300 milligrams of caffeine per day is a safe amount. However, with caffeine, no one is actually average. So that guideline is pretty much relevant to no one. If you're a fast metabolizer like you are, actually going above 300 milligrams per day is still relatively safe. It's just a very gradual increase the more coffee you drink. The more caffeine you consume. So 6 cups a day, 7 cups a day, 8 cups a day, you know, that risk is gradually increasing, but it's not really massively going up the more you drink. Okay. However, if you're a slower metabolizer at around 300 milligrams per day, that risk actually almost exponentially starts to shoot up. So going from 300 to 400 milligrams per day for a lot of slow metabolizers represents a big, big increase in heart attack risk.
Okay.
So for them, it's definitely not safe to be, you know, drinking that amount. Yeah. So for those people, we recommend a lower intake of 200 milligrams of caffeine per day, which is probably 3 espressos or 2 cups of filter coffee, something like that.
Okay.
So ordinarily for you, we'd say the standard guideline applies, which is 300 milligrams. So 4 espressos. Like I said, actually, I love coffee too. Even if you're occasionally going above that, it's probably not that risky.
Okay.
However, what we do know is caffeine can have a negative impact on your vitamin D levels. And because you're already in that risk group for vitamin D, the VDR gene you see there, we know we recommend sticking to the lower goal anyway, even though you're a fast metabolizer. So again, as someone who loves coffee myself, what I would say in that case is it's okay if you want to drink more coffee. But as long as you're comfortable that you're on top of your vitamin D levels, and you know, as an athlete, you know, it's particularly important to be on top of vitamin D in terms of, you know, bone health, fatigue, muscle function, lots of things that are reliant on vitamin D. So if you're really confident, you know, your vitamin D levels are fine, then yeah, crack on with the coffee. But otherwise, just be aware that it can have that negative effect on vitamin D levels.
Okay.
So yeah, does that all make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. It's really interesting. Like both the two major points being the carbohydrate thing, and the you know, the power endurance makeup. There'll be two things actually I should now go ahead and think about and how that's going to change diet and training. Yeah. So it's really interesting actually.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear. Yeah, it's always nice for me speaking to another runner as well, because I can obviously relate more things.
Nice one. Nice one. We'll hopefully catch up soon.
Yeah.
Cheers, man. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, interesting report. Interesting report. So, I'm a power athlete, Jermaine. I should be a sprinter.
And eating meat.
Eating meat, yeah. Cutting down those carbs, running fast. That's what I'm going to be doing for the next 6 months. Just watch me. Watch me go.
Maybe it's possible, like loads of the new people are like, could be, you need like a sugar diet, you know?
Yeah, it's true. Know? Yeah. I bet there's some people who are like, oh, well, I know examples of people who can just eat as much carb as they like and just doesn't seem to make a difference to them in terms of their weight and their stuff. So yeah, perhaps it's there will be just a sugar-based diet coming out soon. Not for me. I'm going to keep it down and keep some other stuff. But hey, we should look at our reviews, because we like to read out reviews. We like to get reviews. We love to get them. Well, we've got one extra. We've got some more ratings.
That's more than enough.
We can discuss it. And the title of this review is, it's the best running and bus driving podcast around! All of those words had capitals as well, which gives it extra feeling. Do you know what I mean? Thanks for that.
Extra punch. Punchy.
It got 5 stars, and I'll start reading it, and then you'll know whose it's from. So, any podcast that interviews the Turbo Ferret, not once but twice, deserves 5 stars. And he's got a nice emoji with a man with sunglasses on. So, thanks for that. It says, fantastic banter, running advice, and interviews keep me entertained for my run commutes. Another emoji, the thumbs up emoji. So as you can imagine, that's from the Turbo Ferret. If you've not heard from the Turbo Ferret, listen back to a couple of shows. The last London Marathon show, we interviewed the Turbo Ferret, friend of the show, long time friend of the show. He talked about his marathon performance. He ran really well. I think he ran 2:21 or 2022-23 at London. Apologies if I got that wrong. But he, yeah, good show. You can listen to his interview post-run back on the London Marathon show. So yeah, check it out. Nice for the review. Get them in, people. We do love reviews. It does help us to grow the show. I know everyone doesn't listen.
We need that love. We need the love.
Yeah, I know people listen to it on different platforms and iTunes isn't that easy to do that, but if you can do an iTunes review, it will really benefit us and the show. So thanks for that. What's your plans for the week, Jermaine? Anything going on?
Just working, obviously. Because I've got so many stories now and I always forget them when you call me up.
Yeah.
I've got a little notebook now. So when something happens, I park the bus up and I'm writing in my notebook. Yeah. People think I'm writing lyrics or I write a story. And I'm thinking, no, this is for my podcast. I've got to write another story out for the people.
That thing is going to be worth a lot of money now, Jermaine. People are going to want to steal that off the bus. You've got to keep
that
under wraps.
You're going to take off me. Say, oh, we're going to get rid of Jermaine. Don't worry, we've got his notebook. We'll just get someone else in.
Yeah. Someone who knows the difference between Tongo and Togo.
Hey, we're supposed to be buddies.
Nice one. Right, I'm going for my lunch, but we'll talk again next week.
All right, see ya. Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.